You're listening to Civic Media. You can tune into any of our live shows on any radio station across the state with the Civic Media app. Find us in your phone's app store and listen anytime, anywhere.
What is up, everybody? Welcome to the show. What a week we've got for you today. Episode, whatever. Hey, I'm glad you're here. And you're going to be glad you're here because this is going to be awesome. I mean, this story dominated the headlines this week and 50 years ago. And I've got the right dude to tell us all about it. We're going to take a sidestep with the politics and we're going to talk the legend lives on from the Chippewa. We're talking Edmund Fitzgerald with author. He put on a different hat.
Yep.
Because we've talked politics on this show.
Well, at least I didn't put on a Boston Red Sox hat.
I got that. I know. We're talking Edmund Fitzgerald with Tom Nelson, who has authored a brand new book on the sinking.
Yes.
Holy cow.
Great to be on.
Appreciate it. The book.
Okay. Well, this book project goes back a couple of years ago, and I have, like a lot of people here in Wisconsin north of 30 years old, have always been entranced by this story. And for me, it goes back to trip up to Sault Ste. Marie to the Valley Camp Museum. I was about 7 years old and I was just kind of gravitated toward the Edmund Fitzgerald exhibit. And my dad kind of explained, you know, what this was all about. And on the wall had the names of all the crew members. And next to that were the lyrics for the Gordon Lightfoot song. But in front of you, in the middle of everything, was one of the retrieved lifeboats. And I'm 7 years old.
The mangled one?
I'm getting there.
Okay,
and
sorry.
Maybe I'm like 4 feet tall, but walking up to the bow and just looking how it was torn apart, like there was a can opener that just cut it open, walking closer and closer to it, like I'm being swallowed up by the shark. And that feeling image has never left me. Now, fast forward many years later, I'm running for lieutenant governor back in 2010, doing a fundraiser, surrogating for Tom Barrett, and someone down in Milwaukee starts talking to me about the Fitzgerald and how the Fitzgerald fit into the greater economy in the 1960s and 1970s. And I kind of put two and two together that here's this fascinating story, but there's more to it than just this legend and more than this tragedy on Lake Superior. And So I was kind of noodling on that and turning that over my head. And then after my last election for county executive, having spent a lot of time at the doors and thinking through things, I'm thinking, you know what? I'll get this on paper. I think this is a book. So I started talking to people, interviewing people, researching, reading, knocking on doors, in fact. And within 4 months, I had done all the research and had written the first draft of the book. And it was published last August because the publishing process is very long.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Very long. Usually it's like 2 years. You write the book.
Oh, my God.
And then you go through the line editing and the publisher and on. And then they identify a good time of the year to release it.
Yeah.
And so in this case, it was a lead up to the 50th anniversary.
That's a good time to.
But I wanted to jump on that just because it's a smaller university press and knew that it was going to be a lot of interviews like this. And by the way, thank you, Civic Media, for taking such a great interest in this. Appreciate it.
Yeah, so this book has taken years to work on.
Yeah. So I've been kind of turning this around, but when I put two and two together, the personal experience and the politics and the public policy and the business models next to it, it just all came together.
It's interesting because when I was little, one of the images that haunted me and stayed with me was the picture of the stern of the ship upside down and, you know, saying Edmund Fitzgerald, Milwaukee. That frightened the hell out of me.
Yeah.
Like it did. And that was one of the questions that I had for you was, why has this grabbed a hold of Midwesterners and just like not let go?
I think it goes more than just the Lightfoot song. Although if it wasn't for that song, we wouldn't be talking about this.
Yeah.
Think of the Fitzgerald as a movie. A good movie that does very, very well has compelling characters, compelling drama, and a kick butt soundtrack. And you put those three together and you've got a winner. And I think that's what happened here, those three things coming together. I also think, too, the way that this all started, you got to put it in the context of American history. this happened in 1975. The song came out a year later, 1976. And 1975, 76 was not our finest hour in the United States. We had just gotten out of Vietnam. You had Watergate. You had the Frank Church committee hearings about the CIA. Later, yeah. You would have a JFK conspiracy house committee. And it was just like, eh. And I think that like Americans were looking for, were desperate for heroes.
Yeah.
And if you were to look up heroes and you were to look at the definition, read the definition, it's pretty darn close to the Fitzgerald crew. And I think all that came together and like a legend, a legend doesn't have to take years and years to form. Mm-hmm. If it forms instantly in 75, 76, you have this for years and years. Yeah. And that's part of the reason why I think it has done so well. I know you want to get a question here though, but I don't want to forget this point. Now, my book looks at this completely different than any other Fitzgerald book. Most Fitzgerald authors are shipwreck enthusiasts. Mm-hmm. Okay. I don't have a shipwreck background. I have a politics, public policy, the little guy getting worked over by big corporations. And what I found in this is it's the exact opposite narrative of the Titanic. Mm-hmm. And that's the other shipwreck we all know about. The Titanic was this Titanic ship, this massive ship that just could not sink, but you had a knucklehead captain that ran to an iceberg and then it sunk. Uh-huh. So we've kind of grafted that narrative, I think, on the Fitzgerald when it was the exact opposite, in that the ship was a mess. It was only a matter of time before that thing was going to sink. It was in that bad a shape. And you had a captain that, although a cowboy and running that thing hard, he had a lot of incentives from the boss to run it hard, run it heavy, as many times as he could throughout the year. And so it's the exact opposite. And that's part of the reason why we haven't got the story straight, why it's taken, in my estimation, 50 years to have light shed on this, that we can get a better, more clear picture of what actually happened to the Fitzgerald in 1975.
I think too, you know, you talk about legends, and one thing that I think helps too is here in Green Bay and at other places in Wisconsin and all over the Midwest, you still see one of those characters. He's like the Arthur Anderson. It's mm-hmm. getting fixed now, but it steams into port.
That's right.
You're like, oh my God, that's the one. And I, you know, it was interesting. I was watching that, the documentary, I think Fox 6 did it.
Yep.
And I was watching and listening to your commentary, and I'm like, wow, Tom, like I know Tom as the firebrand political guy. And I'm like, he's really, and then they said, what did in the Fitz? And he's like, well, it was corporate greed. And I'm like, there he is, Tom Nelson, everybody. It was awesome. And talk about that though, because it's fascinating.
Yeah. And I'm glad you brought that up because there's another thing that, this thing's getting hot and heavier. I got to take the jacket off. I think I got some sunlight on my back.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So when you're looking at the politics and the economics behind this, you start to get a clear picture of what was happening. And there were three other ships that were in proximity of the Fitzgerald that night. Mm-hmm. There was the Sykes, there was the Ford, and there was the Anderson. And the Anderson was 10 miles behind the Fitzgerald. So in a lake the size of Superior, they're basically on top of each other.
Yeah.
So the control variable here, if you will, is the business model.
Yeah.
The Ford was owned and operated by Ford. Yeah. The Sykes was owned and operated by Inland Mining. I think that was the name. It's defunct now. And the Anderson, U.S. Steel. So those are owner operators. Fitzgerald was not.
Right.
The Fitzgerald was owned by Northwestern Mutual in Milwaukee. That's why it says Milwaukee underneath Edmund Fitzgerald, okay. You know, the stern, that's why it says that. And that's actually technically its home port. However, it's operated by Oglebay Norton. So in other words, Fitzgerald was a rental.
Okay, yeah.
And on the night of November 9th and November 10th, 1975, it was actually a rental of a rental. Because that night, it was coming out of Superior going to Zog Island in Detroit when its normal route is Silver Bay, Minnesota to Toledo, hence the nickname Toledo Express.
Oh, yeah.
And the reason why is there was this mutual aid agreement among steel companies or carrier companies that said if they had a load that had to come from Minnesota or wherever it was down lake and they didn't have equipment or a ship up there, they would contract with someone else. So there was no incentive to keep the Fitzgerald in good shape. If you rent a car, you don't care if the wheels fall off in 2 weeks after you've left it. Okay, they beat the heck out of the Fitzgerald.
Yeah.
They brag about how they were beating records, how the 1968, 69, early 70s, that they were doing 30,000 tons, 31,000 tons. And as we all know, per Gordon Lightfoot, it was 26,000 pounds then it or 26,000 tons, then it lay empty. That's a line in the song.
Yep.
And so they're running this thing 20-25% greater than capacity. And they're not just doing it one off. They're doing it like 2 years in a row, 3 years in a row. And she ran about 40 round trips or 44 round trips. Think about that. 120, 150 round trips or going one direction at least. That thing is full to the brim. It is going 25% more than is certified by the American Bureau of Shipping and the Coast Guard. On top of that, when it was coming back up, I mean, they were just, that thing was firing on all cylinders. So it was worked hard. It was run as fast as it can. And then the early 1970s, it was outfitted with a new engine. And it was like dropping a V8 into a Toyota Camry and without making any modifications. So the long and the short is the Fitzgerald was not seaworthy. It should not have been on the lake on November 9th and November 10th of that year. And it was only a matter of time before it would sink.
Wasn't there some sort of an inspection before too that was like, hey,
yeah,
you probably...
Oh, that happened every year. So it's inspected once or twice a year. So okay. They knew exactly what was going on. The smoking gun, if you will, in all of this was a deposition that was conducted by Steve Ekman, his law firm in Minneapolis. And Steve Ekman was able to track down what I call the 30th crew member, Red Bergner. He was the cook, and he was the cook, but he had a doctor slip that said he shouldn't, you know, I think he had like, indigestion, some sort of medical condition.
Great timing for that.
Right. And so he's like, yeah, I'm just going to stay back hunting Texas where he was living. And that was that. And so there was another person that came in, Robert Rafferty. And by the way, his daughter came out to see me at my Toledo book stop.
I saw that.
I know. It was just absolutely amazing.
How
gosh, total
surreal.
Honor. Total honor. And so he basically spilled the beans. This is chapter, I think, 4 or 5 called Just Call Toby. And it goes through the legal aspect of the after action after it sank. And he spilled the beans because he knew the Fitzgerald inside and out, was on it 10 years, wintered with it 10 years. And he knew, he actually took the executive president of either Ogle Bay Norton or Northwestern Mutual, took them down into the hull, into the keel, showed them the keel, how it was falling apart, how they were tack welding pieces of steel and said, look, you have got to fix this. This is, you're going to lose your cargo. You're going to jeopardize the life of 29 crew members. Something has to be done here. And that happened several times.
Wow. And so this is the corporate greed. They knew.
Oh, absolutely.
That there was some serious problems.
Absolutely. This is not something. And this came out in a deposition, federal court in 1977. So this isn't some news article that appeared in the, you know, Cleveland Blade or in the Journal Sentinel.
Right.
This was something where there was someone that was deposed by an attorney in federal court. And they had in the room also legal representation from the companies.
Wow. We're talking with author Tom Nelson about his book, Wrecked. And we're talking about the story of the Edmund Fitzgerald. This is fascinating. Stick around. We will be right back.
You're listening to Civic Media. Stay up to date on the latest news and information for your local community and Wisconsin by signing up for our free email newsletter. Visit civicmedia.us/email to get started.
Welcome back. What are we done with this? We're sitting down with author and county executive, Tom Nelson. We're talking about the Edmund Fitzgerald. We should have played a little Gordon Lightfoot. Missed opportunity here by me. No, this is fascinating. Okay, so we're at the point where the ship is like, meh, falling into, we need some maintenance. Mm-hmm. This was going to be the last run, right? And then it was going to go?
Possibly, okay. Likely. You know, you never know. I mean, it was there during a really bad storm. November is the worst time for sailing because very few sailed in December. So November is usually the last month of the season. So my guess is just a guess, but it was toward the end.
Okay. It's weird because I'm driving to the studio and there's a big ship that's sailing out into Green Bay. And I was like, ha, how about that? Yeah, because it gets bad.
Yeah.
On the Great Lakes. And what makes them so dangerous?
What makes them dangerous is it's kind of in the sweet spot where it's still a lake and it's really big, but it doesn't have the same dynamics as a sea. So, you know, being out to sea, you have like these like rolling waves. And so a ship that's built for the ocean just kind of rolls along. But on the Great Lakes, the waves are close together. It's very choppy. It's just completely unforgiving. You have these rogue waves that can exceed 40 or 50 feet on Lake Superior. So it gets really bad. You have the wave action. And then what happened on November 10th is you had the, you know, warm front coming up from the Texas Panhandle and mixing with the cold front coming down from Canada. And that's what led to all the precipitation and led to the wind and really, you know, created these awful conditions. And I would say that we probably haven't gotten this point yet, but we will, which is the proximate causes. What put things over the edge? There are several theories. There is the hatches that weren't secure, running aground at 6-fathom shoal.
Did that happen?
The rogue, what?
That he did run aground, you think?
Bernie Cooper, who was the captain of the Arthur Andersen, who was 10 miles behind the Fitzgerald, he was absolutely convinced.
Yeah.
He passed away in 1993, 1994. So for 20 years, he held on to that.
Right.
He is the closest to an eyewitness. So you have to give that a lot of weight. Some people who have dived the Fitzgerald, inspected part of the ship, because part of the ship is upside down. Mm-hmm. Half of it is and half of it isn't. And so they looked at it and said, look, you know, there's no scrapes. This thing didn't go aground. You don't know for sure because it's split in half. Mm-hmm. And you just, maybe that's where it went aground. So that's one of the theories people like really hold on to. The hatches, that was big at the beginning because when they sent a remote vehicle to look at it, spring of 1976, it showed that two of the hatches were like popped off. Mm. I want to talk about the hatches even if the hatches were not secure, okay? This is a classic blaming the worker.
Yes.
The hatches weren't just, you know, it wasn't just this latch that kind of snapped. What held these hatches together, and there were 21 of them, were these industrial size C-clamps.
Yep.
C-clamps. And each one, you needed, I think, about 60 or 70 C-clamps. Multiply it by 21, you're talking 1,300 or 1,400 C-clamps that you have to seal. It sets sail on Sunday. How much you get paid on Sunday?
Yeah.
Time and a half, double time. So they didn't want to spend a lot of money doing that. And they did rely on the crew members. It wasn't uncommon not to seal every single hatch. Right. Was it the case of the Fitzgerald? Maybe, maybe not. But even if they weren't secured, that's a really good example of how the boss is being cheap, trying to cut corners. And, you know, by then, the middle of the 1970s, you got to think that there was technology to be able to secure that tightly, especially if you have a cargo of 26,000 or 30,000 tons of taconite ore. That's worth a lot of money. You know, each of those loads, you could probably build 12,000, 13,000 cars.
Yeah.
Pretty big.
Yeah. Well, and if you have one of those and it's secured with how many of those clamps?
60, about 60
so,
or 70.
I would imagine that you put even a third of them attached onto one.
Right.
That's one of those, that ain't going nowhere.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
We're talking about Tom Nelson, author of the book Wrecked.
But I want to qualify this too, though, because this is rightfully a sticking point for family members. So I don't want to spend too much time talking about that or saying that it could or couldn't have. But what I want to say very clearly, this was not on the workers.
Yeah.
Absolutely not.
Right.
Family members for years, because of the Gordon Lightfoot song, you know, the hatches gave way, thinking, oh my gosh, it was their fault. There was negligence. It's on them. That's totally not true. This thing was not seaworthy.
Right. Did they get a payout from?
So
was it less than what they should have gotten?
Well, according to attorneys I interviewed, that the deductible that Ogilvy Norton had, now keep in mind Northwestern Mutual, they're basically absolved of this because they had what's called a triple net lease with Ogilvy Norton. And there's one kind of company that knows how to write an airtight policy. It's going to be an insurance company. Right. So this really fell on the operator. And they had about $1 million deductible. So the message was effectively, okay, there's $1 million. We're not going to spend anything more than we absolutely have to. So you take $1 million divided by 29 families, it's about $35,000. And sure enough, when you talk to families, like I talked to Pam Johnson, Robert Rafferty's daughter, said it was like $35,000. Yeah, $35,000. And they signed them up and they settled. And so by the time people were aware that this was something that you could sue them for. I mean, they lost a loved one. It was not seaworthy. It was on the company, I think. They never really ascertained that because all these were settlements. Some families who didn't sign originally, now keep in mind, they came from small towns, so they don't have the same kind of legal resources. But there were a few people. There was an attorney up in Superior, Toby Markovich, who represented three families. One of those family members received, I think, a six-figure settlement.
We're going to keep this discussion going with Tom Nelson talking about the Edmund Fitzgerald and his book Wrecked. Stick around right after this on the Civic Media Radio Network. We're sitting down with author Tom Nelson. If you like what you hear, be sure to like our page on Facebook and all the social media stuff. Download the episode, share the episode on civicmedia.us, wherever you get your podcasts, all that stuff. How's the book doing?
It's doing really well.
Surreal, right?
Yeah, no, we are the top seller in the Michigan State catalog.
That way.
So that's my published in the Michigan State University Press. They've been around since 1947, so there's a lot of competition there. Totally humbled by that. And part of the reason why is it is the 50th anniversary, but it's because I think that I have something new to contribute to this 50-year-old story. And very excited about this, and it really has exceeded expectations.
So you just write this and then you just try to find a publisher?
Yeah.
Like, hey, I got this thing.
Right. So
really?
When you write a book and you pitch it to university presses, you don't need an agent. So you can just find these emails and fill the form and send it in. And sometimes they get back to you, sometimes they don't. So Michigan State University Press saw this, one of their editors, and said, we got to get this. This is amazing. So we signed the contract right away and we start the process to get this ball rolling. That was back, I think, December of 2023. Came out last August. So as I mentioned before, or maybe it was offline talking about how it takes so long to write these. So that was a lead up to it.
Wow. And did you have the book written when you signed the contract?
Yes.
That's crazy.
Yes. So I should mention my one of my contributors with author was Lawrence University history professor Gerald Padere. He was absolutely indispensable. He did editing. He kind of consulted on this. He's published a lot, so he knows the ropes. He was absolutely indispensable. He was also the one who encouraged me to take this up in the first place.
Oh, cool.
Although I had thought about this, talked about this for a while, there was, I think, two or three other ideas I had that I pitched him on, and he said, this is a book you want to write. This is history.
Nice.
This is history. This is a fresh topic. This is a fresh approach to it. Do it. So that's how that'll begin.
You talk about the tanking of the economy as well.
Mm-hmm.
How did that?
Well, that was comparing, that was using Fitzgerald as a vehicle literally and figuratively that carried the U.S. economy because of its role in moving taconite ore from Minnesota and to this case to Toledo, Ohio. And there were more ships as well. So what happened, it was, you know, turned into steel used to make more ships, cars in Detroit, machine tools in Milwaukee, paper machines in Green Bay and Appleton, all over. And so the Fitzgerald was more than just this tragedy. It was something that was absolutely indispensable for the U.S. economy because of their work. Think of all the hundreds of thousands, if not millions of jobs that depended on the 29 crew members of the Fitzgerald.
That's crazy.
So that's how it affects all of us. And it's not just a cool folk song, and it's not just this romantic kind of story of these guys out there and this tragedy they go through. This represented one of the most important components of the U.S. economy in the 1960s and 70s.
So, and I, it's funny, I made a post, because of the things that I've read, whatever happened to the Fitzgerald, it nosedived and smashed into the, and because it was so long, it was very likely that the end of the ship was still out of the water when the nose hit the bottom of the lake, which is like, it's just mind blowing to think about how big that ship was. What happened to it? And people were like, "Oh, ships, no, that's not what happened. It broke." Everyone's an expert.
So one of the reasons why there was a ship that sank in Lake Michigan in the 1950s, and that ship broke apart on the surface. And we know that because there were actually survivors. And they looked at how the Fitzgerald broke and what was happening, where it's sloshing back and forth. And in that, you've got, you have three compartments of taconite ore. So each one has about 8,000 or 9,000 tons, but the divider between these three holes is very permeable. So if you're out there and you're battling 10-foot, 20-foot waves in this kind of storm, you're going back and forth, it's very likely that it's breaking these holes and maybe going to the front. Mm. And so it's weighted toward the front and then nosediving. So that's one theory. And if you look at the side, if you look at a scale model of Fitzgerald or an ore ship, and you look at it, it's like a barbell where you have this thin in the middle and then you have these big weights at the end. And you're looking at this and like, of course, this thing snapped in half.
Right.
Look at where the tension is. And if it's something that's not been maintained, it's in horrible shape, it's only a matter of time for it to sink. And that's the reason why the Fitzgerald sank. The Anderson, the Sykes, and the Ford did not.
It's crazy. One of the documentaries that I think they interviewed the captain of the Anderson, and he made a comment of at the time where it was likely that the Fitz sank, they thought that they saw the lighthouse in the distance, but he made a comment of like that could have been the bow of the Fitzgerald up in the air, and we just didn't know that that's what it was. Well, how, I can't even imagine that sticking with you.
I know. This is chapter one. I begin the book with a blow-by-blow account, minute-by-minute account on November 9th and November 10th to kind of set the story. In the last page, I talk about how Bernie Cooper and his first mate, they could see the Fitzgerald light. So they're about 10 miles away.
Right.
And on the other side was another ship that was coming in from the ocean called the Avifers. And I interviewed the son of that captain.
No way.
Oh yeah. And that was very insightful too. And that's in the book as well. So what happened is they were looking ahead. They saw the lights and then they didn't see the lights, but they could see some lights beyond that, which was the Avifers. And that's when they knew it had disappeared and probably sank.
Wow. What do you think happened? Do you think it ran aground?
I don't know. It could be any of those. I think they're plausible, but they're proximate causes. Yeah. They're things that kind of tip the scales. The reason why the Fitzgerald sank, the underlying cause was it was not seaworthy.
Right.
And it was only a matter of time for that thing to sink. And of course, there hasn't been another ship that has sank in the last 50 years. So that tells you that this was a very exceptional case. It was a very exceptional ship. It was a very exceptional ship because of the business model, owner-operator. It was not maintained. There's a federal deposition that showed, in fact, that it was not. All these reasons conspire together to say, yes, the Fitzgerald was the exception. That's why the Fitzgerald is the only ship that has sank in the last 50 years.
There was a commentator that I was watching, you know, in preparation to talk to you, and he made the comment about, and he's like a ship, I don't know, historian guy, and he said that night with the where the captain of that ship is, it's right in front, and so they're going into these waves, you know, if they're big, that ship is likely taking water right to the front and just seeing, you know, and they're waiting to pop out, and so they go into the sea and then waiting to pop out. And he said, if one of the theories was true, they would go down and they could have likely hit the bottom of the lake.
The ship's 700
before they
feet.
Even knew what was going on.
Absolutely. So the ship is about 700 feet long and the depth was 535 feet.
Yeah.
So think about that. It was very possible. And there were waves that were reaching 30 or 40 feet. It is entirely possible. Also, by that time in 1975, the clearance, so to speak, there's another term for it, between the top of the ship in the middle, the clearance between that and the lake was about 10 feet.
That's nothing.
That's 10 feet.
That's nothing.
I know if the Chicago Bulls fans are correct and Michael Jordan walks on water, he could have dunked on the Fitzgerald back in 1975.
Right.
It's not going to take that much. You know, you're overfilling this. It's just, it's been beat to the ground or to the lake. And it's no surprise you add up those factors, those facts. I mean, I've been getting this firsthand accounts. I mean, the material, the primary source material, it paints a very, very clear picture in my mind.
You have been someone in your political life who has always fought for the workers, fought for the little guy, understood what it means to be someone who could be taken advantage of. As you're writing this book, was there a point where like the blood started to boil and you're like, I got to take a second?
Yeah. Oh yeah. You know? Absolutely. I'm like, I can't believe it. Why hasn't anyone, you know, told this story? Why am I either the first or the second peer-reviewed published academic book ever on the Fitzgerald? We talk a lot about it. There's a lot of self-published. There's people who, of course, you know, Gordon Lightfoot fans, though, but there really hasn't taken, I mean, there really hasn't been a really, really serious look at this question from a perspective different than people who are interested in shipwrecks and shipwreck enthusiasts. I spoke to the Bay Area divers in northwestern Ohio. I did their keynote address over the weekend. And so that's a group that they like dive shipwrecks. Yeah. And so I wasn't coming from their background, but they were very, very well, you know, they were very familiar from that perspective on the Fitzgerald. And what I showed them and what I explained this to, I mean, you could drop, I mean, you could hear a needle drop. They were just kind of looking at it because this is completely new. It wasn't their background. Yes, you can examine the Fitzgerald, try and find out why it sank, what the significance is it by looking at a different perspective, looking at it from a business model, politics, public policy, political economy, and it paints, I think, a very clear picture.
It's interesting. We'll see, you know, the documentaries and all that, they really paint a rosy picture of, oh yes, you know, the Fitzgerald would have, it set these different records, and then all of a sudden, you know, it set a record for tonnage that was passed, and then they had to change how it's, you know, and it's like, oh, this is great. That killed people.
Yeah.
That killed people.
Mm-hmm.
So
I think another reason why people can, are attracted to the story because they can relate to it.
Sure.
Everyone knows someone who has worked in a factory, worked at a paper mill, worked at an auto plant, a machine shop, who got a pink slip. And got a pink slip because the boss, the company, was not making the right investments. They were cheap. They were allowing the industry and the business to fall to foreign competition. They were dialing back on worker protections. All of those things. The same thing happened with the Fitzgerald. The only difference is those workers paid the ultimate price.
And their family's got 30 grand.
And their family's got $35,000.
My God.
And it's just, I mean, it was just insulting. But see, a lot of these families, they didn't have another income stream.
Right.
And they came from small towns like Iron River in the case of Michael Armagost. And in those cases, they had some of the biggest paychecks in town. Now, it was, you know, it was commensurate with the kind of risk that they took. And they were away from families for 8 months or 9 months. And they were such sizable paychecks that when one of the crew members married and the parents and the brothers and sisters no longer had the income stream because it was going to his new family, there was a lot of tension between the in-laws.
Really?
I mean, these were very important paychecks. These are families that went through this horrendous loss, not knowing why their loved one sank, who was responsible, but they were strapped for money. They needed to get some sort of income. This company says, here's $35,000. We'll take it. Yeah. I mean, think about that.
How do people get your book?
You can go to Amazon. You can go to the Michigan State University Press. You can go down here to Lion's Mouth. I will be giving my talk at Lion's Mouth this Saturday at 3:30 p.m. Gerald Poder will also be there too. So come on down to Lion's Mouth and learn more and pick up a copy.
That is awesome. Tom, thank you so very much.
Great.
Fascinating stuff. Thank you very, very much. We'll
absolutely
talk some politics a little later, all right?
All right.
Stick around for my thoughts on the Rational Revolution. Thank you very much. Just like yesterday, then I'll get on my knees and pray. We don't get fooled again.
You're listening to Civic Media. Find the latest news, information, and archives of all your favorite shows on the Civic Media website, civicmedia.us. Just another word for nothing left to lose. Nothing. I mean
nothing, hon, if it ain't free. Welcome back. Oh, wow. Tom Nelson, what a story, man. I mean, that Edmund Fitzgerald thing is something that, I, you know, if you're listening to the show, you know that story. You were probably taught it in elementary school or you heard the song or, you know, and it's, I want to thank again, Tom Nelson, his book Wrecked, the story of the Edmund Fitzgerald and how it tanked our economy. You got to get it. Tom, awesome, awesome stuff. What a surreal thing. And I want to talk about something else that's surreal that happened to me. And it's still kind of happening a little bit. I was left unsupervised on Monday night. And I was watching the horrific Packer game. And I was also reading an article that was about how the Supreme Court was striking down and keeping the rights for gay couples to be married. And it was awesome. I was reading these articles because like, man, how we've been over the last few months, there's so many bad news stories out there. And so to see people that are kicked to the curb constantly, to see their rights affirmed, that felt good. That was cool. I felt good about that. And I was reading this article and kind of riding on a high. And I, again, left unsupervised, I stumbled across the phone number for one Kim Davis. Yes, that Kim Davis. And I, against probably better judgment, at like 10 o'clock at night, I sent her a text message. And I said, hey, Kim, I need to see this clearly. Say this clearly. Your version of Christianity where the Bible is used as a weapon to justify prejudice is ugly and deeply un-American. What you've done stands against both the teachings of Jesus and the values of this country. Jesus never preached hate or exclusion, and he certainly never said anything about being gay. In America, your faith is personal. It's not a tool to force others to live by your beliefs. Come to think of it, though, Jesus did condemn hypocrisy. I shut my phone off, I went to sleep, woke up the next morning, went to work, and I totally forgot that I even sent the message. I wasn't drinking, I don't really do that much. And I looked down at my phone and I was like, oh, I got a weird text message from some 606 area. Oh my God, it's Kim Davis. She responded. She responded. Like that, Kim Davis. The Rowan County clerk who was famous for doing what she did. And she responded this long, long message and took a lot of time to send this. Bible verses, She said, you're entitled to your own opinions and you're able to voice them. Talked about what makes the country a great place. Quoted the book of Romans. Talked about inclusiveness and tolerance and love is the truth and God is love. All this stuff. And she said, you know, I don't even know why I sent you this message. She said, don't pretend to know me, she said. I stopped issuing all marriage licenses to all couples because I didn't want to discriminate against anyone. And then she ended, so please don't pretend to know me and then judge me unrighteously. I will stand before the one and he will be my judge. And I was floored. I was floored. You talk about surreal things that I would never think I would be doing on a Tuesday. Texting with Kim Davis was not one of them. And so I was like, all right, I probably got one shot to send her a message back. And I don't want to be a jerk, you know, whatever. And I sent her a message that said, I don't question your faith, but I do take issue with the way it's being used to justify actions that hurt other people. I told her, I don't pretend to know you, but I know a lot of people like you, including some in my own family. You create God in your own image and your own likeness because the only perspectives and attractions that and experiences that seem natural are the ones that you experience yourself. I told her that in the LGBT community, there are people of every faith, every race, every background, and they deserve a government that serves them too. I said that our personal faith can guide how we treat others with compassion and integrity, but it should never dictate who the government serves and who it does not. And she did some research on me too. And this is a lesson for me. She screenshotted a post that I sent about a day before our messages. And it was an article from the New York Times that said, Supreme Court denies request to revisit same-sex marriage. Brought by Kim Davis. And it's in that article, it showed a picture of my brother. And this picture is actually in the Smithsonian. It's really cool. It showed a picture of my brother waving the pride flag in front of the SCOTUS building on that day, you know, many years ago when the verdict came down. And the comment on my post said, this just in, Kim Davis sucks. And so she screenshotted that and sent it to me. Whoops. That was a lesson, by the way. If you wouldn't say something to someone's face, don't put it in on Facebook. I would not tell Kim Davis to her face that she sucks, but whatever. But I said to her, you know, the article that I shared from my post, that picture is from the New York Times and that's my brother. Kim, I speak for him and millions of Americans that are like him. And we spent the rest of the day texting back and forth. We exchanged a handful of messages. And I do plan on putting pen to paper and talking about this because there's such a big conversation to be had here. And I appreciate Kim taking the time to message me because it's clear from her messages, she really did put a lot of thought into it. She talked to me about how she grew up as a Democrat and how she didn't go to church until she was 30. And, you know, and the last thing that she talked about was how her faith is like her skin and she can't take that off. And so my message back to her was, well, if your faith is like your skin and you can't take it off, can you see the hypocrisy in you discriminating against someone who is gay and they can't change that about themselves either? What a weird, wild exchange. Kim Davis. Wow. I'm going to talk about this more. I'll probably write an article about this, and you can read the full messages at some point. But man, wow. Crazy stuff. But I guess the moral of the story is stand up for what you believe in. Always. Always fight for what is right. And hey, that's what we do on The Rational Revolution. We will see you next week. My thanks to Tom Nelson and the Civic Media Radio Network for letting me blab for an hour every week. We'll see you next week on The Rational Revolution.
The national news cycle never stops, but it can be hard to find news about your local community. Civic Media is dedicated to providing quality local and state news coverage across Wisconsin. With the Civic Media app, you can get notifications about local stories that matter to you and your community. Find the free Civic Media app in your phone's app store and choose notifications from the menu to tell us what kind of news you want to hear about.